Welcome. My name is Anke Voss, and I'm the director of the Champaign County Historical Archives here at the Urbana Free Library. I want to thank you on behalf of the Urbana Free Library for joining us to hear these extraordinary Illinois stories from three remarkable local women: Yuki Llewellyn, Iris London, Lundin, and Jill Knappenberg. Berger. I'm sorry. There you go. I'm sorry. Thank you, too, to Mark Leff, Associate Professor of History from the University of Illinois, for agreeing to moderate this conversation. And finally, our gratitude here at the Urbana Free Library to Kimberly Kranick from WILL for inviting us to be a partner in making this event possible. Kimberly.
Thank you, Anka. Thank you, everyone, for coming. In the killing that engulfed the world between 1939 and 1945, 50 to 60 million men, women, and children died. The vast majority of them were civilians. 85 million people served in uniform. About 16 million were Americans. 405,000 airmen, soldiers, and sailors from the U.S. perished. Will you join me in a moment of silence to remember the military men and women who died and were injured, and the civilians who were killed and injured? Thank you. WILL is pleased to bring local stories of the war to you tonight, and also to bring you a new series that you may have been watching on WILL television called The War by Ken Burns and Lynn Novak. It took them 6 years to produce this film, and they interviewed over 50 people in four small towns in the U.S., one in Connecticut, Alabama, Minnesota, and California. And this story is told from the perspective of the soldiers and the civilians who were alive during this time, and that is what makes it unique. We know that about 1,000 veterans a day from World War II are dying, and our goal is to preserve as many of those stories as we possibly can, as well as civilian stories. So since about June of this year and through next year, WILL will be recording the oral histories of veterans. If you yourself are a veteran or know someone, please see us, because if you are willing, we would like to record your story. You will see some local stories tonight produced by our producer, Denise LaGrassa. We are also airing local stories on radio. You may have heard those reports. And we are putting all the oral histories on our website as well, and we will donate them to the University Library and the Urbana Free Library. So you may access all that material on our website. We want to show you a brief segment from the film, and to let you know, if you have not seen it and want to see it after seeing this, we are repeating the series. We started the repeat last night, Wednesday night, from 8 to 10:30, and that'll happen consecutive Wednesdays. You can see The War from 8 to 10:30 on WILL. And on Sunday, we will also broadcast several segments as well. So there will be many opportunities to see that. So we want to also let you know that we're working very closely with teachers. Teachers want to get local stories into the hands of their students. And so we are also very glad to see some Central's high school students here with us tonight. We're glad that you came. Let us go now into a segment from The War. This is an introductory segment. It's about 8 minutes long. And then we will go into our local stories. We'll hear a story about Yuki Llewellyn, who was interned in California because of her Japanese heritage. We will hear a story by Jill Knappenberger, who served overseas in something called the Clubmobile. And we will hear directly from Iris Lundin, who was a navigation instructor. So let us start now with the film from The War.
One evening in the summer of 1941, several months before the United States would be drawn into the Second World War, in a little farming town in Alabama, a 16-year-old high school boy named Glenn Dowling Frazier discovered that the girl he loved was interested in someone else. Frazier was so angry and upset that when the owner of a juke joint refused him service, he stalked outside, climbed onto his motorcycle, and roared through the door, shattering bottles and smashing furniture. As he raced away, the bar owner chased him down the street with a shotgun. The next morning, humiliated, scared, and unable to face his parents, Glenn Frazier went to the nearest recruiting office, lied about his age, and joined the peacetime army. He volunteered to serve in the Philippines.
When I volunteered for the Philippine Islands, I had no idea that we would actually be in war. I was thinking that probably Germany was the most likely place that there would be a war. So in my mind, I thought it'd be safe over there. I never thought Japan would be attacking us.
Over the next 4 years, Frazier would find himself in the midst of war. Desperate hand-to-hand combat. A forced march so brutal, the world would never forget it. And nightmarish prison camps, where simply surviving required luck and bravery and unshakable will. Back in Alabama, those who loved him would be told he was dead. All Glenn Frazier would be able to do was cling to the hope that one day he could come back home.
I don't think there is such a thing as a good war. There are sometimes necessary wars. And I think one might say just wars. And that I never questioned the necessity of that war, and I still do not question it. It was something that had to be done.
The greatest cataclysm in history grew out of ancient and ordinary human emotions. Anger and arrogance and bigotry. Victimhood and the lust for power. And it ended because other human qualities, courage and perseverance and selflessness, faith, leadership, and the hunger for freedom combined with unimaginable brutality to change the course of human events. The Second World War brought out the best and the worst in a generation and blurred the two so that they became at times almost indistinguishable. In the killing that engulfed the world from 1939 to 1945, between 50 and 60 million people died. So many, and in so many different places, that the real number will never be known. More than 85 million men and women served in uniform. But the overwhelming majority of those who perished were civilians. Men, women, and children obliterated by the arithmetic of war. The United States of America was relatively fortunate. More than 405,000 soldiers and sailors, airmen and marines, died. But that figure represented proportionately fewer military casualties than were suffered by any of the other major combatants. American cities were not destroyed. American civilians were never really at risk. But without American power, without the sacrifice of American lives, the struggle's outcome would have been very different. The American economy only grew stronger as the fighting went on. And by the time it ended, the United States would be the most powerful nation on Earth. And a once isolated and insular people would find themselves at the center of world affairs. The war touched every family, on every street, in every town in America. Towns like Luverne, Minnesota, Sacramento, California, Waterbury, Connecticut, and Mobile, Alabama. And nothing would ever be the same again.
I'm not sure I can speak about why human beings in general go to war. I think that's a pretty large category. I can only speak about why 18-year-olds from Minneapolis go to war. They go to war because it's impossible not to, because a current is established in the society so swift, flowing toward war, that every young man who steps into it is carried downstream.
Signs posted on all the lampposts that said, you know, attention, Japanese, Japanese Americans, you are hereby commanded to be at, and then depending on where that poster was posted, you would be given a location. Ours was at Union Station. It was just my mother and me. Hayakawa Okinaga family is how we were listed in the records. The evacuation was, I think, 2 weeks' notice, and we were told that it was just what we could carry. We weren't told where we were going, how long we would be gone. You were even 1/8 Japanese. It included you. There were primarily students who protested and said, hey, I was born in the United States, I'm an American, what happened to due process? And they were promptly jailed. We were all Americans, but it didn't matter. I could see large families getting separated, but everyone had a number and a tag on. When you got on the train, they pulled down all the blinds so that not only could you not see out, but of course people could not see in. Everyone was sent to an assembly center first. Interestingly, on the records of Manzanar, it said that my family and I arrived in June when we actually arrived in March. And that was because it was an assembly center from March until June, and then June 1 it became an internment camp. When we got there, barracks were still being built. They put to work all the able-bodied people who were internees to help build the barracks. We shared barracks with other people until the blocks were all formed and the barracks were done. The only thing I can compare it to is horse stalls. Those were kind of the size of all of them. It's just that ours was never a horse stall. They were built. The bathrooms were located centrally, but there were no doors on the stalls. I remember that. And so people would take blankets and hold up blankets for their parents. So if you had to go in the middle of the night, you had to take your blanket holder with you. My mom hated that more than anything, the lack of privacy, the inhumaneness of being treated like that. Mess halls were social centers, because that was when you actually could gather together. They didn't like people meeting, but they had to feed you. People were not eating the white bread and the beans. I guess our people just said, we would like to provide the cooks. Don't bring the white bread, bring sacks of rice, and we will start a garden. So the food was great after the initial introduction to Army food, which we didn't like at all. But my mom and I were not very well-to-do in Little Tokyo, so it was kind of a luxury to know that you were going to get fed three times a day. I was in the elementary school, and I have pictures to prove that I was there. The neat thing about camp to a kid is that you celebrated all the holidays. So we had Christian holidays, Jewish holidays. We had all the fun holidays for kids, even though they weren't Christian. Didn't matter. So we had Santa Claus. We had Easter Bunny. Teachers were whoever was incarcerated. They did have some Quakers who volunteered to come in and teach. And I would say there are a lot of people who were in the camps who would do anything for the Quakers because they volunteered, and we saw them a lot. We were encircled by barbed wire, and there were guard posts with an armed guard in the towers. There was a child who was shot when there was a group of them trying to get outside the barbed wire. So, of course, all the children were told, don't go anywhere near the barbed wire. The suicide rate among the older people was pretty high. They blamed themselves because they were the ones that were from Japan, brought the family over to the United States, and it was because of that that they were being incarcerated. People started leaving camp if they had some place to go, because on the records, not only did they put down what day you left the camp, but where you went. My mother and I were by ourselves, and we didn't have any family, so we were one of the last ones to leave. We left in October, and we went to Cleveland, Ohio, because there was a sponsor family there that said, we'll take those two people. Each family was given $25. You have to think in terms of how much that was in 1945, which wasn't a lot, but it wasn't piddly little either as it is today. We met returning GIs on the public transportation. We were, generally speaking, treated fine, and I think it was because of our gender and age, but we were thrown off a train to leave room for soldiers. And I don't think the soldiers asked to have us thrown out. It was just that the people in charge thought that that would be a better use of their vehicle. The redress movement came to a head when it became really clear that our government should not have done this. There were people who lost everything, their family home, land. There's a wonderful song in South Pacific that you have to be taught how to hate. And the opposite is also true. If you celebrated all the holidays like we did and accepted them, nobody would be different.
And now we'll go into another locally produced TV spot that's been airing on WILL. This one will be on Jill Knappenberger, who was and the Clubmobile in, and it was in the Battle of the Bulge. And after that, then we're very happy that history professor Mark Leff from the University of Illinois will moderate our panel. And we hope that you'll ask questions. So after a little discussion up here with the panelists, then we'll open the floor up to you for your questions.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Former American Red Cross volunteer Jill Pitts Knappenberger recalls her service to the military in World War II. From 1943 to 45, Jill drove a 2.5-ton refitted military truck filled with refreshments like coffee, donuts, candy, and music.
Well, they just loved our being there and serving them coffee and donuts. And it was one of the best jobs they ever did because it meant so much to them, and we were doing something that nobody else could do.
Her mission?
We're bringing cheer, mainly, and hometown spirit to these boys, and they were glad from the break. They've been on the line in combat, and it's just relaxation. We were working with the greatest people on earth, the American GI.
This traveling symbol of warmth and recreation, known as the Clubmobile, was conceived by Harvey Gibson, commissioner of the American Red Cross in Britain. Mr. Gibson wanted to extend hospitality service to soldiers fighting on the front lines of battle. Women interested in serving as a Red Cross recreation worker had to meet physical and educational requirements. After pre-screening and operations training, the women were sent to brighten the spirits of battle-fatigued soldiers waging war against the Germans.
When they first came up to meet us, it was a joyful thing, cheery. And they'd want to know, where are you from? Oh, so-and-so's from there. And of course, we did have these registers alphabetized by the states. And the GI's first thing they want was to see that and go to their state and look through there and look for the name of a buddy. And that we quite often did get them together. We had 75 RPM records that we played and a PA system. They loved it. And everybody looked forward to mail. It meant an awful lot. Sometimes the field artillery boys would let us pull the lanyards on the guns that we could shoot the Germans. I've done that more than once. We'd go out to the different divisions with corps. In the meantime, before we go, we'd make all these thousands of donuts and coffee. And it was a new adventure for us to go where all these different units were, but we never were with any long enough to become close friends. Things were moving pretty fast.
A crew of three Clubmobile girls, as they were known, often traveled with infantry combat units to isolated areas.
Each unit was individual. Ours was the one farthest advanced and got into the most trouble. Helen Anderson, Phyllis McLaughlin, and Jill Pitts. We were the only three women actually caught in the Battle of the Bulge.
Unlike her female counterparts, Jill knew how to drive and repair the heavyweight Clubmobile. Her keen abilities were recognized, and she soon began teaching other Red Cross girls how to drive.
They brought in two girls that had superior driving records, and I was one of them, to teach the new girls coming from the USA how to drive these things.
During a lull between the exchange of enemy fire, Jill traveled to an area where her twin brother Jack, a battery commander with the 106th Army Division, was embedded with his troops. She was planning a party and wanted to introduce Jack to Helen, her friend from the Clubmobile.
That was a Saturday night, December 16th. It was her birthday, and I wanted her to meet my twin brother Jack. See, I had seen Jack just 2 days before. We'd had it all arranged. It was going to be a party that night. Well, that didn't happen. When we got there, we found we were cut off and surrounded. There was very little communication. because the enemy had cut the communication lines. There was no ammunition coming in, no food. We were just isolated in this little pocket. We had an assimilated rank of being captain if we were captured. So that was quite a shock, because at that time the field director came up and told me that my twin brother had been killed that morning trying to help some of his men. And that's devastating. But you keep going. It's not like here you're going to go home and cry on your mother's shoulder. You can't do that. And this was part of what we signed up for. We didn't expect it, but we tried to keep people happy there and spread the cheer that we could. And we were there for 8 days before the 82nd Airborne came in. Then they told us to pack a musette, which is a little shoulder bag, with what we wanted to carry out with us. Put an incendiary bomb in the Clubmobile, because we weren't going to have the Krauts have our supplies. In the meantime, the 20th of December, I think it was, we opened our Christmas presents that came from home, because we didn't know if we were going to get them open. And we were prepared to crawl through the lines and just waiting there, and they were to inform us, and then they came back and said one road had been opened briefly and we could drive out. We'd be led out by a Jeep with a colonel and a captain, two GIs. Of course, I did the driving, and I'm following these taillights on this Jeep, not very far behind. And all of a sudden, those taillights disappeared, so I stopped. We walked up the road a little way. Trucks bringing in ammunition. The Jeep was total. The colonel was out unconscious on the pavement. And of course, this is the very fine single line of escape, so we had to pick up the colonel and put him in the Clubmobile, push the Jeep off the road because we couldn't have it blocked. It was the only road to escape. And put us in the back of the Clubmobile. We didn't know where we were to go, except to get out of where we were. And we were directed to a forward CP command post and spent the night there. Till they came at 4 o'clock in the morning, get out of here as fast as you can, because we've lost the only roadblock between us and the enemy.
After her escape from the Bulge, Jill wrote a letter to her family. With measured words, she carefully concealed the news of her brother's death.
I was sworn by the Army not to mention that he'd been killed because they were to be the first to notify the next of kin. I couldn't mention it for 30 days, so that was one of the worst letters I ever had to write. I could write and say I'd seen him, you know, and I did take some pictures.
As she left Germany at the end of the war with her camera still intact, Jill photographed scenes. Morbid scenes of the concentration camps.
We couldn't believe that one human being would treat another human being with such horror. And when I did see the lamp that the commandant's wife had made from the skin of some of the inmates there. And there were piles, 4 feet high, of just bones. We just couldn't believe. Well, it's almost like you can't believe that what the terrorists did to the Twin Towers.
Let not the defeatists tell us that it is too late. It will never be earlier.
I'm a little one.
Tomorrow will be later than today.
We need more peace.
Okay, so we're going to have our panel now, Professor Leff, and panelists, if you would come on up, we'll get started with that.
How in the world can we follow stories that were as compelling and dramatic and heartrending and inspiring as the ones that we just saw The way we can do it is that we have the stars here. Yukiko, Okinaga, Llewellyn, Jill, Pitts, Knappenberger. And not only that, we'll have a bonus story that will appear soon, that of Iris Lundeen. I'm Mark Leff. I teach 20th century U.S. history at the University of Illinois and teach courses on war and society. You know, the opening piece that we saw from the war made a point more eloquently than I do in class about combat bringing out the best and the worst in people. And in a, and it says it sometimes blurs the two. And that really struck me because it wasn't even talking about different people when it is talking about the best and the worst. It often reminds us that it can bring out the best and the worst of ourselves. That and certainly this was a war with, and what we saw in the war with inspiring bravery and patriotism at the same time as we saw haunting moral choices and, as the opening piece put it, unimaginable brutality. Just as there's that contrast in the series, in some ways there's that contrast in the stories that we're going to be discussing today. We have here women who were inspired to serve and did so in a way that, that we can all be awed by. And we also have a woman who was a child, was a victim of one of the most outrageous violations of the freedom that we in the United States like to think of ourselves as having fought for. One of the themes of, I guess, of this series, and one of the things they keep repeating, is that there are so many extraordinary stories out there. And there are intergenerational lessons from those stories. There are eternal lessons from the stories that we hear. And WILL, at least here, can't recognize or showcase all of them, though I certainly we all should thank Anka Voss of the library for making it possible for us to have this event, and Kimberly Kranick from WILL and so many others for what they've contributed. We can't tell the story. We don't, for example, one of the most natural stories, I guess, to have told would have been of the Rosie the Riveter, the women industrial workers, and I hope they'll be able to collect interviews of those sorts of stories too. Let me start, and it actually is an interesting take on some of the stories that we don't hear, about some of the exceptional stories we are able to hear. And so let us start with Iris Lundeen, who taught navigation within the, she was a member of the Women's Marine, Marine Corps Reserve, Women's Union of the Marine Corps. You know, when historians talk of that unit, sometimes they talk about downsides of that movement. They talk about how the Marine hierarchy, you can see the memos, was very worried about the treatment that some women receive in the Women's Marine Corps Reserve received from male Marines. They talk about other downsides. They talk about the fact that the in the set with the segregated military, there were there were African Americans in the services, but in segregated units, and in fact, in the Women's Marine Corps Reserve, there were not African Americans. But at the same time, they point out that here too there are exceptions, and that if you look at the 30 specialist schools of the Marine Corps Reserve, there were breakthroughs that are really notable there. And particularly, I mean, one of the ones that is highlighted is aviation and navigation, where it's said that ended up, that was one of the most open-minded parts of the service. And in fact, in talking to Iris Lundeen, she had stories to tell that were the more positive side of the way the kind of respect she received as a woman instructor, and even certain instances where the recognition that was given to African American Marines and the protection of their dignity as fighters for this country. So I want to give her a chance to tell a story that you'll be able to see, I think, fairly soon on WILL, and maybe just tell us a little about how you came how you came to the Marine Corps. You could have chosen to be a Rosie the Riveter. You could have chosen to spend your time doing other things. You chose to go into the Marine Corps. Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
I had been teaching for 2 years, and I was working the second summer, and I had a little interference with a person at work, and I quit, and I said, I'm going to join the Marine Corps. I didn't even know what the uniforms looked like. I just went to the recruiting office, and I said, there were two other girls in there, and they said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to join the Marines, I think. And they said, man, you must think you're pretty good. I thought, well, I'm here. And, you know, in the service, you don't choose what you want, you know. There are no such things as volunteers. It's you, you, and you. And so I ended up as I did because of that situation. When I went in, the reserves were very new. I was in the sixth group of women. And I did boot camp at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Then, because they were short of people, I did boot camp and mess duty and the whole works. And when I went in, I could have gone in as an officer, but I said, oh, I'm not going to be a 90-day wonder. I'm just going to work my way to whatever. But Patty Berg, if any of you remember that golfer a long years ago, she was in the group that I went, and I don't think she ever did mess duty or anything. They used her to advertise the women. But you lived scared because you didn't want to wash out, as they said, meaning you didn't want to be sent home again. And I had worked away from home since I was 13, so I knew how to dust those lousy Venetian blinds and so on for Saturday inspection and kinds of things like that. But there is nothing that I could have done in the Marine Corps that would match Jill. No way. So what else do you want to know? I did, after they needed officers, so anybody with a degree, they sent to officer training school. Finished that, and then I was supposed to go to quartermaster school in Philadelphia, and the night before I was to leave, there was a change of orders, and I was to go to Hollywood, Florida for navigation school. And I didn't know what navigation school was. I didn't know how, well, I knew where Hollywood, Florida was, but Never seen a palm tree, never been to the ocean because I was from northwestern Wisconsin, which is pretty sandy and no water, but lakes. So I did the training down there, and I had to take instrument flight training. So that if you look at my uniform up there, those wings do not indicate that I was a pilot. That means that I had instrument flight training, and I had to have that. Then we had to take radio, radar, LORAN, which is long-range navigation, and then celestial navigation. And in the celestial navigation training, that nobody had heard of a computer in those days. But in Quonset Point, Rhode Island, we trained with the Navy again. Most of this was Navy training. There was this huge silo, and in the top of that silo was a fuselage or the cockpit, I guess I would say, of this plane with this huge instrument panel. The top of the silo was wired. You could look up and see all the wires and bulbs and so on. But on this instrument panel, if I had have been wanting to fly over Champaign, over Urbana Library at 10 o'clock tonight, I would punch in all of that information and then punch the final button, and right up there were all the stars that would be over tonight. Sirius, you know, Orion is beginning to show. I would have been able to see all those. And the worst part of that was that I was supposed to be able to maintain this. And I thought if they say fix it, I was going to lay down and say take me home. Because how would I know how to do anything like that? But this was part of what we were supposed to do. Then after that, I went back to Cherry Point and did some duty and outlying duty down in South Carolina. But I ended up with having one class of 13 young men from beginning to finished navigator. So they went from my class to being on planes as navigators. It was tremendous. We had night classes and for stars, and we had daytime classes. I don't remember how long it was, but it was every day from 8 o'clock until 5. And the training that I had I could have had a job as a meteorologist anywhere when I came out, because you had to know weather, you had to know a tremendous amount of things. And the best part was, when you were talking about discrimination as far as male and female, there was never, not one time in those 2.5 years that anybody ever said, you can't do that because you're a female. Not ever. The thing is, if you did a good job, you were accepted, and if you didn't, goodbye. The fellows that I had in that class disobeyed all military rules. When we finished that class, they presented me with a gift. Beautiful, ever-sharp pen and pencil, gold with my name on it. I never dared show that because I wasn't supposed to have it in the first place. But, the other thing that was nice was you never knew what a person had done before they were in the service. And I met one man who had been very helpful to me in navigation school. Later I learned that he truly owned a town, a little, they made yarn for sweaters, and he owned that whole town. I had no idea how wealthy that man was. Afterwards, they were at our house, and I was at his house. But during the service, I had no idea what he did. You were accepted totally for what you did, which is a nice situation. So I probably earned a PhD while I was in there, because sometimes when I was in celestial training, we went to school from midnight until 8 o'clock in the morning. And you were with brainy people. I met some people who were so tremendously bright that scares you to think about it. My bunkmate in boot camp was one of the prettiest and the smartest women I've ever known. And plus the fact that she could do anything. She spoke about 6 languages, plus sign language. But best of all, she was a ventriloquist. And it was wonderful because, here we were in boot camp and having to stand in our platoon and do all of that marching and learning, and those young men who were our DIs, our drill instructors, hated it. They would rather have been in front of 40 guns than to have all those dumb women. And here we would be standing, and you were supposed to stand at perfect attention, you know, and he would give orders, and then Betty would talk. She'd probably say, "Oh, you're so cute," or "Are you married?" or something. And he couldn't tell where it was coming from. And it was so funny. And one day he was so mad, he just said, "Dismissed." And we went. So there were light moments, too.
You know, we're not going to be dismissed. And I think this is and in fact, we can celebrate people who, for what they did and for what they contributed. And I've been able to spend time with people on this panel, and it would be selfish of me to continue right now asking them questions, because I've had a chance to ask them questions. Can we open this up to questions that that you'd like to ask for any of the members?
How did you put your knowledge to work? What did you do?
Afterwards?
While you were there.
I was teaching. See, I was a navigator, and they need... in fact, if you look at those pictures somewhere up here, I was one of the first four women navigators in the Marine Corps. As I say, who knows what happens, but that was you. And they needed us, and so there we were. They didn't have men, so they used us.
Okay, could you raise your hand when you want to ask a question so we can bring the microphone to you? Thank you.
I have a question for Ms. Llewellyn. Rounding up American citizens and throwing them in camp strikes me as completely unconstitutional. And I'm wondering, how is it justified, and were there any legal challenges? It seems like that should have ended up in the Supreme Court.
It was. They upheld it. It was a time of war. It was an executive order from the president. I think he probably still has that power to make an order and say that that's the rule of the land. So the people who did protest were jailed. In fact, of the camps that were set up, Tule Lake held the honor, I guess you could say, of being the prison for all the civil rights workers who tried to fight the law. You couldn't fight the law. It wasn't until after the war that people said, "Oh, gosh, I guess you weren't guilty of anything. Sorry." So,
you know, one of the aspects of this that interests me as a teacher is there's the famous case that okayed the Korematsu, that okayed the relocation. There was a decision that did lead in late 1944, of course, to a release from the camps, and no one had to stay there afterwards, which said that if you actually know that you found out people are loyal, which they were, if you know that, you couldn't keep them there. And not only that, but since then, there have been effective overturnings of Korematsu because even that decision was reached with very misleading military evidence that was supposed to show that the military had actually felt that there was a threat, and the evidence was phony. And when they found that, again, that case has been discredited in the legal circles too.
I have a question for Ms. Llewellyn.
Yes.
How do you go from being? I know you keep from work. How do you go from being someone who's treated like this as a child to someone who embraces everybody like you did at the university?
Well, thank you for that, Mark, but I was a child, and it was like, for children, it was like living in a commune. Everyone looked like you, and everyone took care of you. There were no scary stories about muggers or, you know, come home at 7 o'clock because you don't know what will happen to you. Everyone took care of the children. I got lost one time, and I was in another block. I didn't know what block I was supposed to be on. And a woman who looked very much like my mother said, "Hi, I don't think you belong here." And I said, "Where am I?" And said, "Well, let's go have some cookies first." She was swell. But so for children, if I didn't have my mother to remind me every day, because she lives here in Champaign, she still will not talk about her experiences in camp. She's bitter. And I think, you know, she's allowed to be bitter. I don't want to say anything to her because it won't change what happened to her. It had to have been terrible. If I was 3 years old, she was 23. No husband. My mom and dad had split up just before Pearl Harbor. So we were in camp as a family. And a lot of things came about with the redress movement in the 60s. But I want to tell you that when I was going to school after the war, there was no talking about camps. There was nothing in the history books that said that there were camps. So it was like, oh, I guess I better not talk about it. I guess it didn't happen. I guess it was all a dream. But I was very lucky to have been a child for that experience, because I see some older women now who were parents or high schoolers who are very bitter because they lost more of their life than I did. Although I have to tell you that when my son was born, I had him experience everything in the world because there was nothing like that to compare it to when I was growing up. He hated that. He would say, "Mom, you know, no more soccer. Mom, no more gymnastics." And this is a 5-year-old kid. So I didn't know what you did as a kid, because there were no movie theaters, no cars, no sidewalks, no pets. Certainly no television. We did get movies after a while, but the irony of that was a lot of the Western movies were made right outside the camp. And so it was like, who are we rooting for now? Oh, the ones that look like us, the ones that are getting killed.
Can I know I am violating, we want more questions, but I have to ask one question before we go to the other, and that's to Jill. And because it's, I know it's on a lot of people's minds, the drama of what you went through, you know, strike, of course, strikes all of us. If you, and I'm not talking about the personal tragedy, I'm talking about what you saw. And what, if you knew when you joined, went with the Red Cross and, you know, decided to work with the Club Mobile, if you knew what you were going to see and experience, would you have done it?
Oh, we had no idea what we were going to see. I certainly would have done it. It was a wonderful experience. I had one brother in the Army and one in the Navy, and all my high school friends and college friends were in the service, and I wanted to be a part of the action, too. Patriotic, and I still get a big thrill out of seeing an American flag. I had taught Red Cross life-saving when I had a civil service job in Decatur just before I signed up to go with the Red Cross. All I knew is that I was going into recreation work. I really didn't know about Clubmobile then until we got to England. And I thought I'd probably go into a club, aero club on an air base or something. But when I found out about Clubmobile, which that's what I wanted to do, and it was very exciting and thrilling, and the fellas loved it because we're bringing a part of home to them. Some of them hadn't seen American Girls for a while, and they loved us that we didn't have the British accent, and we could talk about the baseball games at home and so on and so forth. And then when we went to the continent, of course, we volunteered to do that. That's when we had to learn to drive the 2.5-ton GMCs, because the Green Line buses that were part of the Lend-Lease with Britain that we used for Clubmobiles in England could not be taken to the continent. We had drivers, English drivers there that helped us lift some of the heavy things, but we were young and pretty vital, and we could lift the 5-gallon cans of water and so on. And but after we hit the continent, of course, then we saw the bombed out villages of San Lo and Avaranche, and our first dead Germans. We never saw the Graves Registration Boys took care of the fatalities on the Allies. We never saw them because they took care of them right away. But when we liberated the atrocity camps, the first one that was liberated was called Ordruff, O-R-D-R-U-F-F. And that was in April of 1944. And it was really quite an eye-opener for all the Americans. In fact, a couple of three generals came back to see this bodies hanging and others that had been starved to death and the pits that they just put lots of bodies in. And then Buchenwald, which was liberated near Weimar in May, we saw that when there were still bodies in the crematoriums and these piles of ashes that they just, what the Germans do, just shovel up a little bit and put in a little vial and send it to somebody. This is your, whoever it was. And, of course, they had also taken all the gold out of their teeth and collected that. They took all the glasses out and used the metal rims. It was really quite an eye-opening experience. But you adjust in wartime to different situations. If I'd seen that first thing, it probably had a greater dramatic effect on us. But we got used to being in combat and the noise and eating in mess lines and eating out in the rain and having lots of experiences that the combat troops did.
Okay. I'm afraid we're almost out of time, but we can have a couple, maybe one or two more questions.
Actually, we can go till 8:30, actually. It's as
great.
Long as people
great.
Want to go.
Great, wonderful. Then let's keep going.
Hi. I just had a question. This is for all three of you. Looking back on your lives now, how did your experience with the war shape your lives to come? How did it alter your perception on the world? And I guess I'm particularly interested in your lives as, more as your roles as women, as wives, as academics, as workers, as mothers, after you went through these experiences.
Well, like any experience, you adjust to circumstances. I don't know how it has changed my life particularly. I came back and got my degree from the University of Illinois. I'd had 1 year before I went into the service. And that's when I met my future husband, who is now deceased. He was a local lawyer because my father had established a memorial scholarship at his fraternity for my twin brother who was killed. He said, I have a daughter here in school. Introduce her to some of the boys in the house. Well, I met my husband, who was wonderful. And after I was graduated in 50, I was on the extension staff at the university as the home advisor for Marshall Putnam counties. And the county seat is Henry, Illinois, the slogan of which is the best town in Illinois by a dam site. It has a dam on the river there. And I worked there for 2 or 3 years until I married and moved to Champaign. And, of course, it's town and gown. They're two different associations, kind of. And so I just became a homemaker. But the experience, I suppose, had my experience overseas during World War II was a broadening experience for all of us. No matter what we do, we grow with that. I might not have met my husband if I had done that. I don't know.
I had met my husband before I went in. I saw him and I decided at first glance that that was the man I was going to marry. He didn't know it, but I did. It took me 3.5 years, but I came home and I was married. I took my uniform off and put my wedding dress on because I didn't have any time. My parents were not at home and I didn't have any place to go, so we decided as long as we're getting married, we'll get married right now. So I was home 8 days. I still was in the Marines, actually, but at least I took off the uniform and got married, and it was wonderful. I had no problems whatsoever. Because I wanted to marry him anyway, so.
Well, the relocation camp really did shape my life as a young adult and adult, and now an old lady. But I have to tell you that the civil rights of Americans is so precious. But, you know, we have to speak up when there's a violation. That's what happened to the Japanese Americans. They did not speak out. And the few who did got jailed. But what if 120,000 people spoke up? So I tend to be a loudmouth. I tend to criticize things our government does that seems to be kind of crushing people's civil rights.
That never happens.
Oh, right. So I have to be careful about my comments, although I'm not too careful. But it did show me what silence will do. And I would like to think that the newer generations, I see it, are more vocal. If there's something going on, they'll say, hey, wait a minute, what is that? What's due process? What does that mean? Oh, it's just due process for you. It's not due process for everyone. So it did shape the way I thought after I became a grown-up.
One for Yuki and one for the moderator. I thought, was I right that the Japanese American men were in the army? That they were.
They volunteered.
Oh, it was only if it was.
Oh, they, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They volunteered. Yeah. But they took.
The 442 of Hawaii?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And to the moderator, How about your students, and how do they? Actually, how much do they know about World War II?
Things have changed. Well, first of all, even the issue of the soldiers from the 442nd and the 100th, even that issue, which is dealt with in this series in sometimes heartrending ways, given some of the places that some of the situations they were put in and found themselves in. This was the most decorated unit in World War II, was the 442nd, the Japanese American. Some had been drafted, and that is part of the idea. First you volunteered, and by the way, volunteers from Hawaii, where there was not mass internment, volunteers from Hawaii came very, very quickly. But can you imagine asking somebody who is in one of those camps to then to then volunteer? It gave you. I mean, there were so many cross pressures. Yes, you're a patriot. Yes, you want to help the country. Look how you've just been treated. But then there was a draft, and some people refused to go. That's one of I teach a course that involves a number of weeks on the incarceration, mass incarceration of Japanese Americans, and students know so much more about that now than they did when I taught 20 years ago, and one of the reasons is, I think, because of people like Yuki. Because in 1988, as the piece that we saw indicated, the United States, the Congress passed and President Reagan signed something that not only reiterated the national apology for having removed people's civil rights, because two-thirds of those who were placed in camps were American citizens. They weren't. They were citizens like just about everyone in this room, and yet, so there was an apology for that, and any survivor of the camp would receive $20,000. But it wasn't only that. People like Yuki who said that there needed to be an apology and something needed to be done. That law also said people need to know about this. And there were funds for teaching about that mass incarceration. So the result is my student, 30 years ago, my students didn't know anything about, or knew very little about mass incarceration. And now they come in knowing much more. That's
like a lot of them thought there was no such thing as the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And well, you know what really strikes me about that? I mean, it's one of the values of this series and of a forum like this. Even if they do know, even for the things that they do know, to be able to have it conveyed by people you can see, that people you know, and conveyed with the kind of emotional impact of this series, I think makes a tremendous difference.
This is a question for the whole panel. You all remember World War II. How do you think Ken Burns did on his show?
Beautiful job.
Yeah, covered it all.
Accurate?
I think he did a fine job. Some people think he jumped around too much, but I like what he did.
I like knowing some people and tracking them. I thought that just made it personal for me. It also hurt me.
Yeah.
When something happened to them or their families.
those of you who've seen this, I'm sure all of us have some people who've seen the series, have some people that have especially reached us. One of the exceptions, Yuki and I were discussing this, one of the exceptions in the series, generally it goes for, it follows up on people from four different places. It makes an exception for Senator Inouye, and his appearances, Senator Inouye's appearances in this, talking about, I mean, even talking about combat, much less talking about the kinds of what Japanese Americans confronting, is so compelling. But the other advantage, I think, that they had in this series is, I mean, they had some of the people they interviewed, just like the people here, are, you know, have stories that are so extraordinary. And you know, I don't know about the rest of you, but you know, one of the things that really struck me when Tom Hanks reads the column from that small newspaper in Minnesota, it was like it should have been written for a play or something. The eloquence of and you know, the Sledge memoir and so, I was really moved by the series. I was sure.
Got a question. Very, very interesting panel, and thank you so much, all of you, for participating for us today. My question is to you about what was it that people had that they could only carry with them? What did they take with them from their homes to the camps?
People with children took clothes. If you look closely at the picture of me, I have multiple layers. I also didn't know how to button my coat. But since you didn't know where you were going, it's like, do we do winter clothes? Do we do summer clothes? Do you think the kid will grow up? Do you think we need bigger sizes? It wasn't so much what you could carry because, first of all, anything Japanese was destroyed. They didn't want to be seen with anything from Japan. So china, paintings, photographs were all destroyed. And in a personal note for myself, the things that you couldn't take that would have killed me was you couldn't take your pets. So you left part of your family when you had to go and catch this train. And my mother, you know, had the bad luck of having a three-year-old. I wasn't carrying very much. I had a little purse. Empty, by the way. So it's like people with large families got to take more stuff, but their choices were just the same. You know, what do we take? What size do you think you'll be?
Can I just add one of the things, again, that really moved me was a story that someone told about what she couldn't bring, and she had this cherished large collection of china from Japan, and she then tried to sell it in the few days before she would have to leave, and people were going around and offering you a penny on the dollar. I mean, they would offer you, you know, $10 for your car. You had to sell. And she got offered some insulting amount for her china, and before she left, she took every piece and threw it against the wall.
It's from Farewell to Manzanar.
When we were told to pack a small musette bag that we could carry over our shoulders, we were going to crawl through the lines when we were caught in the Battle of the Bulge. What we took, it wasn't as big as a suitcase. It was small. A change of clothes, dry socks, some perfume we had gotten in Paris, and family pictures and letters. That was the main part, because we didn't know what was going to happen to us, whether we were going to be captured and imprisoned. And then, of course, if that happened, we didn't know if the enemy would respect us as young women or take advantage of us as young women, which we'd heard a lot of stories about. But the important thing that we put in our musettes were our family pictures and the minimum jail.
And how about you? What did you bring?
I didn't have to do any of those horrible things.
No,
I didn't. Oh, my life was pretty happy. You lived scared because of what you were doing that was entirely new. But there wasn't no great danger. If your plane went down, then that happened a lot of things. But, no, I didn't have any of those dreadful things to think about at all.
I wanted to ask Jill what she did after she came back out of the bulge. We went right back to work. Well, we had to wander around the Belgium. See, we were caught in Germany about 90 miles northeast of Bastogne, where we had left at noon to go to the 106th Division. And there was much confusion. We wandered around. We finally found rear corps run at Charleville-Mézières, and we left our passengers there and then joined the rest of the Clubmobile group. There were 10 groups, 10 Clubmobiles, 3 gals each, and we were at Florenville, and we got there, I think it was December 24th, in some Belgian barracks. We had straw mattresses, I remember. And we were there for a couple of days and then sent right out again on assignment with another. Well, we went back into Bastogne and we had a donut dugout in the compound there, which had formerly been a Belgian barracks.
You better tell them what a donut dugout is.
Oh, well, it was just to kind of a hole in the wall where we could make the donuts in our machines that we had on our clubmobiles, and we could serve out of that building there. It had been bombed out. Of course, where we'd stayed before, in Bastogne. See, we got to Bastogne October 1st of 44 and went on detached service to the divisions in Corps down through Luxembourg, Wilts, and wherever we were assigned. But that chateau had been bombed. The whole top was gone, so we were in a different spot. And then we were sent right out to work. I finally got some leave in May, right after VE Day, which we celebrated in Altenburg, Germany. We were with the 6th Armored at that point, and we celebrated by having no blackout curtains and lights on the trucks and all the vehicles, because we'd just been using cat's eyes for 2.5 years.
Where did you get the dough for your donuts?
Everything came from Mayflower in the United States. It was all in a big 200-pound barrel.
Yeah, she showed me these huge
yes.
barrels.
I was wondering.
Yeah, and all our supplies came from the States. It's the logistics of war, it's amazing.
Did you stay on after the war, after the VE Day?
No, I went home in August on home emergency. My father was very ill, and the war was over, and I lost my twin brother. He's buried in Luxembourg, beautiful American cemetery, where also General Patton's buried there. He wanted to be buried with his men. So I came back just before VE, no, not VE, VJ Day.
Are there, yes, over here.
This is for Iris. Hi, Iris. I'd like for you to tell about the German U-boat.
When I was in Florida, we had to fly four-hour flights out, down to the edge of Cuba and over the Keys and the islands. And one day, oh, and the water was beautiful, you know, lovely blue-green water and clear. And one day, here was a giant ship standing on its head in the water. It hadn't been there the day before. It shook you up a little bit. And I, you know, you get sort of smart and you say, well, I wonder what happened there, because it certainly isn't the triangle that people worry about. But I met a young man who was in intelligence, and sometimes he was Army, Navy, or whatever for that day. And he said, we do not dare tell the people that there are U-boats within 7 miles of this coast. And that's exactly what happened to that ship that we saw that was down. He said people would panic, but there were submarines there. But that's the only evidence I ever saw of that. That was enough, too.
Are there any other? Oh, I'm sorry, in the back. Had to be in the back. Huh? She's going to get lots of exercise here.
Miss Llewellyn, this is for you. I was wondering, as a Japanese-American, did you experience prejudice after the war? And also, whether the experience of the war and the camps strengthened the Japanese-American cultural identity, or if it did the opposite?
The tendency right after the war for Japanese and Japanese Americans was to assimilate as much as they could into the white population. To, in fact, my knowledge of Japanese language is of a 10-year-old, because I didn't speak English until I was about 10. I was told by my mother to not speak Japanese in public. That was really hard because she didn't speak English. But we did everything at home, and then we spoke English. It was a lot of fun in public. What was the other part of your question?
Well, just whether you experienced prejudice from people. I know in the Ken Burns series, one of the Japanese-American soldiers said when he went to work, there was someone on the crew there that said they wouldn't work with the Japanese person. I mean, did you feel any of that after the war was over?
Absolutely. But I looked at it from, I mean, the people I came across were children, other children in school. But they had lost their father or their brother, their sister. So I was the only one they could identify as the enemy. And there really wasn't a whole lot I could do. I learned to run fast, and I did that, you know, after school almost every day for a little while. But if you looked at the kids, you know, they weren't doing it because I was just the enemy. They were doing it because they lost someone in their life. And, hey, I can understand that.
Any additional questions? May I ask the three of you if you would like, you don't feel obligated to leave us with any last you know, words of wisdom for us, or lessons that you think it's that you hope that. That audiences draw from the pieces that they put together for each of you.
My opinion is that we need more communications with each other and more peace conferences working out our difficulties, because it seems for ad infinitum, the world has been fighting each other, killing each other off, and we need to have more peace in this world. That's not very smart voices of wisdom, but that's the way I feel about it. We need more communications and more peace conferences.
Iris.
When I looked at the Ken Burns pictures and I saw these young fellows, I thought my old idea of how never to have a war is still better. Nobody can be drafted unless they're over 55.
Right.
And we'll never have another war.
Right. Right. That's good. Yeah, I remember you said that.
So, I think just respect one another. If you respect someone, it doesn't matter. You don't look at their color, their religion. Look on them as individuals. And go Illini.
Yeah. Kimberly, would you like to?
Well, we are very glad that everyone came out tonight, and thank you for your questions. And I want to thank Yuki and Iris and Jill and Mark for being on our panel. We thank you so much. We appreciate your stories. And there are some things they brought with them, so we're going to end formally right now, but you may come up and speak with each of them. There's a uniform here, there's photographs, there's definitely more stories. We want to encourage you to please fill out your evaluation forms and drop them off, because we do value your feedback on how this program went tonight. And again, tune in on Sunday for more of the war. Go to our website for local stories. And Wednesday nights from 8 to 10:30 on WLTV, we are repeating Ken Burns' The War. I want to thank the Urbana Free Library, Anka Voss, and my television crew here who is documenting tonight. And this will be put on our website in a month or two. And thank you, Mike, for taking photographs. So thank you all, and good night.
Okay.